I've got a beautiful crowd here. Just before we begin, Melody, there was one thing that I think you left off at the bottom of this really well-prepared tome of ways to run the meeting. It just says down here, just keep in mind, the Dave actually asked me to draw attention to this. It's large, well-attended today, very crowded. So it just says here at the bottom, it says, in case of fire, would all members of Alcoholics Anonymous please remain seated until the Al-Anons have vacated the premises. Thank you very much. I am a slowly recovering Al-Anon. My name is Rick Chatuk. Good afternoon, everybody. And as they say in Omaha, Nebraska, by the grace of God and the power of a program called the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, which we practice ourselves, a fellowship called the Al-Anon Family Groups, and the loving but very clear guidance of a big book, black belt, Al-Anon sponsor. It has not been necessary for me to plan any kind of death, yours or mine, since the 10th day of April, 1987, and for that I am most certainly grateful. Yeah, let's have some clapping. My hometown is Oakville, Ontario. Oakville is about 40 minutes west of the downtown of Toronto. And my home group is the Oakville Saturday Morning Al-Anon Family Group. So I missed my meeting this morning, but I am well and truly at a meeting. So very, very nice to be with you. I'd like to thank the Al-Anons for inviting me, and more particularly the AAs for paying for it. Stick around, ladies, there is vindication. The AA treasurer has even said, if you have any more expenses, just let me know. Well, you know, I need a new car. So thank you, but really, really awesome. My wife and I arrived on Monday. Want to let you know that the AAs did not pay for us to be here on Monday. But it was our wedding anniversary, so we thought we'd spend a bit of Southern California time. And so we've done that, and we were picked up by really a spectacular host, Bruce, really kind of a twin. All he has to do is shave his head and he'll look just like me. And standing there, you know, very dutifully with the sign at the bottom of the escalator, and that was just lovely. And that doesn't always happen for any of you, those who ever had to, done this, you know, kind of shown up somewhere to give a talk, and there's somebody waiting for you at the airport. So I'll just share one experience with you. I showed up, I'm ashamed to say that this happened in Canada. I showed up at a conference in Vancouver, and oftentimes you make the arrangements for the host to meet you in the baggage area, and so I picked up my bag, and, you know, a lot of people around, so I kind of look around, and sometimes, you know, they're standing there with an Al-Anon pamphlet, or, you know, they got that stupid grin. But there wasn't anybody like that, but there was one guy standing there with the ripped-off flap of a cardboard box. And so, but it didn't have anything on it. And so I just kind of waited around and allowed the crowd to kind of clear. And he was still standing there, and there weren't many people left, and I thought, I wonder. So I just kind of went up to him, and I said, hi, my name's Rick. You know, I'm here to speak at the conference. Is there any chance that you're here to pick me up? And he looked at his side of the cardboard and said, well, as a matter of fact, I am, and turned it around, and there was my name facing him. I said, give me the keys, I'm driving. Might have had a spiritual awakening, but you're an idiot. That did not happen when we arrived, so it was great, and we had some lovely time with Bruce and his wife Carolyn. And on Wednesday, Lisa and I went down to see a gem, what I believe would be a gem of Southern California, the Pageant of the Masters down there in Laguna. What an absolutely awesome, awesome evening. You can't describe it to anybody. If you describe it, it sounds so boring. Let's go for 2 hours and watch people recreate art masterpieces. Oh, yeah. And then you go there and your eyes pop right out of your head. I would come back just to see it. So bravo. And if you've never seen it and you live here, go out of this world. So we've enjoyed that tremendously and then have had a great time. And honestly, thank you for inviting me back to the South Bay Roundup for the third time. Really amazing. I don't know how that happened. The only thing I can believe is that the people who invited me the first and second time have either left Al-Anon or died. Don't quite know, and it's an amazing thing, but it really is just delightful to be here, and this is and truly an awesome, awesome get-together. It's almost as good as the ones we have in Toronto, so thank you. And the basket, as Danny mentioned last night, and Roger as well, are two great. Haven't we heard three great talks so far from Angie last night and Danny and Roger? Just really fabulous and pleasure to be on a program with you. And so I enjoyed the basket too. And even though I'm diabetic, and they even put in sugar-free stuff in there, and another experience about a basket. Odd things happen when you travel around. You arrive and you're hungry, and I pull into a hotel room in Texas, looking for an apple or a banana or a Snickers bar, and you arrive at 5:30, you're going for dinner at 6, and you're hungry, and there's a basket right there on the counter. So I dropped my suitcase, and it was in this kind of dark cellophane, and I greedily opened it up looking for something to munch on before dinner, and there, to my surprise, was a fine selection of quality hair care products. And I said, well, they may have heard me talk, but they have never seen me. That's for sure. Anyhow, just delightful. I'd like to introduce you to my beautiful wife, Lise. Lise, hon, could you stand up? Yeah, stand up, honey. There you go. That's celebrated our third wedding anniversary just last week, and a 20-year member of Al-Anon. Bravo. Fantastic. And also, before I get into this deal, I'd just like to say how lovely it is to be here with two of my sponsorship siblings, Helen R. and Kathy W. And it's just, there's a special bond, as you know, that when you meet people who are sponsored by the same person. And I've had the same sponsor for 21 continuous years, and Helen for 25, and Kathy for 15. And there's a very, very special bond there. And just an aside, I would just like to say how beautiful it is to meet Kathy's son, Joe. And Joe, you're out, and now you're in. Awesome to see you. Really good. In Toronto, we do this crazy thing. Every time a chairperson stands up at every kind of meeting, they ask us to qualify. We're not quite sure why they do that. I don't know why anybody comes here who doesn't qualify. I think if you come here and you don't qualify, you qualify for something else. But they asked us to do that, and it happens in Al-Anon and in AA, and I guess really kind of it's a good thing that we do that, because those of us in Al-Anon know that anybody can join AA, but you really have to know somebody to get into Al-Anon. So just so that you know, you have a true Al-Anon up here. I've had five of them. Two by birth, a father and a grandmother, but really more germane to the story I need to share with you today, as I've chosen three. And of the three that I've chosen, two of them I met in Al-Anon. I too have the skill that many of us have. We can find them. And so I'd just like to say to you that if you're here today and you're in Al-Anon and you're wondering, when you hear an alcoholic speak, oh man, I'm identifying with some of the things they're saying. Or if you're wondering about your own drinking, ignore anything any of these alcoholics will say to you. Ignore any questions they will hand you to read and answer. And simply at the end of this meeting, come up and say to me, do you find me attractive? And if the answer is yes, run like hell to AA. Because if I think you're cute, you're a drunk. It's just that simple. I can find it, and we all can do that, can't we? It's an amazing thing. Hello, hello, hello. Oh, hello. And we just know what that is, that funny thing. But you know, we have this tradition that talks to us about qualification, right? We heard it read very well here, that the only qualification for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism in a relative or friend. And for much of my time in Al-Anon, I read that tradition as the only requirement for membership is that there be a problem with a relative or friend. I kind of ignored the alcoholism part, and that my focus was on the alcoholic. My focus was on the person who had the disease, not the disease itself. And I stayed focused on that, and I got sicker and sicker and sicker sitting in an Al-Anon meeting, because my focus was on you, not on me. And so the tradition is crystal clear. It says that the only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism. Alcoholism is the problem, and that's what I need to keep my eye on. That's what I need to focus on. So just let's kind of have, you know, I'm a teacher by training, a rescuer by birth. But let me just, man, it's difficult for me to stand in front of an audience and not ask a few questions. So these are real questions, you know, these are real questions asking for real answers. Don't everybody go, oh, what's he going to say? Well, I'm just going to ask you a few questions just to find out who we are, see if we kind of connect with me like I do, connect with me, and just put up your hand. So I'd just like to simply say, how many alcoholics are here in the room? Put up your hand. Oh, yeah, ladies, look around. Your future ex-husband here right in the room somewhere. No, perfect, perfect. Very, very nice. And now, how many people here are in Al-Anon? All right, good. Lots. Yes, it's an Al-Anon luncheon. That makes sense. How many people have chosen one alcoholic? Okay, fair amount. Not many. You know, that's pretty good, actually. How many have chosen two? Okay, there we go. Okay, now we're starting to get real. How many have chosen three? There we go. Some eager hands fly into the air in California. Oh, me. Is there a prize at the end? You've already got the prize if you've chosen three. Okay, now let's get even a little bit more real. How many people have divorced or separated from one and hooked up or married the same one again? There you go. All right. Absolutely. Now, how about this one? How many people have gone to AA looking for one? Okay, there we are. So we know we're in the right place. And so now the question that needs to be asked, and do not answer this one with your hand, but simply kind of internalize this one. Am I who I am because of an alcoholic? Or am I with an alcoholic because of who I am? The only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism. We used to have a public information poster in Al-Anon that said, you don't have to drink to suffer from alcoholism. And we know that that's true. But we think we suffer from an alcoholic. And the only thing that we need to have change is for the alcoholic to stop drinking. And then that happens. It happened in my life. And it didn't get better. He got better. We got worse. Because that very thing I wanted, that very thing that I thought would fix that screaming inside my belly happened. And the screaming got louder. We use these terms in Al-Anon. I hear them here in California. I hear them everywhere. I've used them many, many times. They're victim terms. My alcoholic. We used to use that one a lot when I was in Alateen. Long, long time ago, I was in Alateen. My alcoholic. Like, you know, my car, my house, my pet, my alcoholic. Again, the terminology focusing on the person. There's this other one that I'm hearing around at home now, the co-alcoholic. Oh, my God. The para-alcoholic. Oh! Co-dependent. Really? I'm a dependent. There's nothing co about what I do. The first time I ever heard this one was in Your Fair State up north. My qualifier. That's the first time I ever heard that, maybe 10 years ago. Then over the years, I kind of heard it. And 2 weeks ago, I was in Portland, Maine, about 3 hours north. I know they drove me so far north, I didn't even know where I was. I thought I was back in Canada. And I'm having breakfast on the Saturday morning, and some fellow just 3 hours north of Portland, Maine says, "And who's your qualifier?" I said, I am. Absolutely. But once again, the language reinforces the victimization. The language reinforces my belief that you are the problem. And when I start to change the language, I can start to get better because the 12 steps will work for me only when I'm admitting that I'm powerless over alcohol and alcoholism and something that I've got. That's when it works. Some of the other ones that we use. adult child of an alcoholic. I'm 59 years old. Don't you think it's time just to be the adult? My sponsor says it like this: Rick, sooner or later, you have to realize that it's too late to have a happy childhood. But it's never too late to have a happy life. Amen to that. And the last one that we hear, and I've used all of them. I find myself in toxic relationships. I've been in many toxic relationships. I'm the one who's toxic. And that's the key for the recovery that I have discovered when I've let go of the person who has the disease and have accepted that the qualifier is that committee in my head. My qualifier is that committee that gives me an idea. I've never had a bad idea. Have you? Never. Every idea I've ever had sounds brilliant to me. It just sounds like it works. But as my sponsor says, my best thinking got me here. And the best ideas I have, they didn't work. But when I am living life by my power, when I'm living life by my will, when all that I'm doing, when I'm rejecting any power other than what I think, I am doomed. And the only thing I can latch on to is, that sounds like a good idea, I better do that. So I'll latch on to somebody I can fix. I'll latch on to somebody that I need. I can find somebody who approves of me. I can indulge myself in just outrageous anger and rage, thinking that I feel I'm powerful when I do that. That's what I do. That's what alcoholism, the family disease, looks like to me. Alcoholism is not a spectator sport. We are all in this thing together. And thank God we're all here getting well together. And that's kind of what's working for me. So that's all about a tradition and how that has affected my personal life. And it has allowed me to begin to accept and do these actions, these crystal clear 12 program actions that I'm asked to take. And when I do that, it brings me to the promise. We have a gazillion promises. But in my mind, there's one promise: having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, that I am spiritually shut down when I am living life by my terms. And but when I do those steps, and I don't even have to want to do those steps. Matter of fact, I think the steps work better when you don't want to do them. I think when you just say, okay, you just come to that place where you're absolutely just beaten down. This isn't working. Or I'm sitting in these rooms for years listening to people share, and I say, that's not happening for me. Well, it's not happening for me because I'm not doing what you did. Never asked anybody to be my sponsor. I was just sponsoring myself. By definition, that means I had an idiot for a sponsor. By definition, I wasn't even in program. When is the seminal moment in the history of AA? It isn't when Bill had that white light experience. It's when one met another. That's where we kind of begin. The whole essence of what we are today here in Torrance, California, started when two guys met on Mother's Day in a gatehouse in Akron, Ohio. That's where we trace that, right to that. When one met another. And when we gather together like this, this is when it can happen. I don't know about you, but I didn't have as much fun when I was sitting at home all by myself worrying, wailing and crying and gnashing my teeth. I didn't feel as good as I feel when I'm here. One of the challenges, though, for us in Al-Anon, it might be for AA too, I don't know, but for those of us in Al-Anon, is that we stay focused on the person, but we come here and we find some relief. Well, wow, oh, this is fun. We're laughing and giggling a bit and all that kind of stuff, but I really have never truly admitted that there's anything wrong with me. As a matter of fact, not only is there nothing wrong with me, I'm the good guy. I'm the one that kept this together. Where would this family be if it wasn't for me? You'd be nothing if I hadn't looked out for you. Yes. Yeah. And then we come into here and they say, but you have to accept that you have a problem. It's a big leap if you're a stubborn-headed Al-Anon like me. But God intervened. And thank God I was able to make that leap. Another tradition. This is really important in Al-Anon for me. Tradition five. You know, we have but one purpose. We don't have one purpose. We have but one. That makes it even more serious. But one. Not two, but not even one, but one. And all that we do is help families and friends of alcoholics. That's what we do. That's what we do. And we do that by welcoming and giving comfort, the awesome way that Bruce did that and Carolyn did that. And all of you have done that for Lise and I when we've been here. Awesome. Way you do that for each other. We do that really, really well. We practice the 12 steps of AA or self. And then we encourage and understand the alcoholic. And that one's key. That one's key. That's not like a personal direction for personal recovery for the Al-Anon. And it kind of means go out there and start to listen to alcoholics. It says a few things. I jotted something down. This is from our book, How Al-Anon Works. By going to open AA meetings and listening, we can learn to distinguish the person from the disease. To recognize that the alcoholic, too, is powerless over alcohol. Because didn't we believe that they could just stop? Just say no! It never worked. Didn't we believe that? So we go to open AA meetings and we start to hear them say things like that. We hear really strange things from the alcoholics. If you're in Al-Anon, you go and we're not talking about drinking. They say things like this. They say, the problem wasn't drinking. The problem when I wasn't drinking. What are you talking about? The problem's not when you're drinking. That's our solution to your problem. That's what the Al-Anon says. What's wrong? He needs to stop drinking. And what does the AA say? My problems start when I stop drinking. It bends your head. Or we just need to love them more. Didn't we feel that? If I just loved her more. If I was just there for her more. If I just did more for her, that first one that I had. Then there's this marvelous speaker. You may have had her here. A dear friend in Toronto. Her name is Mari. And she talks about this story about being in Edmonton, Alberta, in Canada, and her children in Jamaica. And it's near Christmas, and they want her to come. They say, Mommy, we love you so much. And she said, I love you too. And they desperately wanted to see their mother, and she desperately wanted to see her children. And she flew from Edmonton to Toronto and got to the duty-free shop and bought a bottle of vodka. And by the time she got to Jamaica, the bottle was empty, and she was drunk as a Lord when she fell down the stairs. They saw her, put the kids back in the car, and they're kind of looking out the back window as they drive away. She loved her children, and her children loved her. But it's not enough to stop it. But we think it was. And we hear the AA say things like that, and we realize it wasn't us. It wasn't my fault. They weren't drinking at me. Dogs bark, fish swim, alcoholics drink. It's not about me. I heard somebody from your neighborhood a couple of weeks ago at this conference I was at in Portland, and he said it like this. After all these years, you think I'd heard it, it was so clear. He said, if alcohol is your problem, you're not an alcoholic. We should put that on our Al-Anon public information posters. Boy, that'd really get us in the rooms, wouldn't it? He said, if alcohol only does something to you, you are not an alcoholic. What is that? We're in Al-Anon. All we believe is that the alcohol is the problem. But then he went on to say this. He said, if alcohol is an answer, you are an alcoholic. If alcohol is your solution, if alcohol does something for you, you are an alcoholic. And I look at the people that I love, my father, my grandmother, those three alcoholic women that I chose. That's them. These, my dear friends in Al-Anon, are the people we love. They're not bad. As they told me when I was in Alateen, they said, Rick, your father has a disease. He is not a disgrace. Isn't that a beautiful thing to hear? They said, Rick, your father is an alcoholic. He is not a bad man. Did bad things happen in the act of drinking? Absolutely. Absolutely. So we need to recover from that. Then one day I'm sitting at a AA conference similar to this, and this was many years ago, and there was a flyer on the chairs on the Sunday morning inviting people to come to a big book seminar with the original Joe and Charlie. And it said at the bottom, Al-Anon's welcome. Our literature says we go to open AA meetings. Our Al-Anon classic edition, that purple book in the description to Tradition 5 says, and we in Al-Anon found it helpful to read the basic text, Alcoholics Anonymous. It says that right in our literature in reference to Tradition 5. So I went to this big book seminar, and I heard this man, Joe McQuaney, who coincidentally is the deceased husband of my sponsor's sponsor. How that happened, that's unbelievable. And he describes on a chalkboard, that's how long ago it was a chalkboard, the phenomenon of craving. It took about half an hour, and I'm watching this intently, and something's happening to this Al-Anon. I'm not an alcoholic. But my Al-Anon instruction is, understand the alcoholic. And after this half-hour description, this man says, now that's why, when an alcoholic is in the bar, drinking all night, and he steps out into the parking lot and falls face first into a puddle of water out there, and someone comes over and lifts him up and says, can I help you? The alcoholic will say, yes, get me another drink. And the penny dropped for this Al-Anon. He really couldn't stop. She really couldn't stop. That when they told me they wanted to, I believed that they wanted to. But as we learn, one, they take one and one takes them. And they're gone. And it's not that I didn't love you enough. It's not that I got angry or that I didn't laugh with you or that I didn't drink with you or that I didn't pay the bills or that I looked at you funny in the morning or that I tied my shoes the wrong way. It's that the people we love are alcoholics, and they're not bad people. And when I can release that, I have available to me the most powerful tool for recovery that I believe the planet knows. 12 action-based spiritual principles, steps, action-based. It's an action-based spirituality. I don't have to think this. You know, that tradition we have in Al-Anon, think, really, with what? Spent my whole life thinking, and got bad. And so I would encourage you to take a look at some of those things in those traditions that actually apply to our personal lives, because I found a forgiveness in that for my father, for his mother, for those women that I was with. I realized that the problem was me. That am I who I am because of an alcoholic, or am I picking alcoholics because of who I am? And that's when I go from the side that says, it's you, to this blessed journey over to there that says, thank God, it's me. Because if I'm here trying to recover from something you have, I will die. It's like saying, I have a headache, please take a pill. I cut my finger, will you put a bandage on yours? That's what sitting here doing that is like. And I did that for a long, long time. I have absolutely no memory in my life of a time before alcoholism. It's been there. Every time I've looked at the end of my arm, there's a hand, and every time I've looked at the end of my leg, there's a foot. And alcoholism has just been there for that long in my life. There was never a time when anybody said, Rick, this is alcoholism. I was just in it. And being in it and being in kind of the horror show of active drinking for many, many years, until I was 18, my dad didn't get sober until I was 18 years old, we know what that's like. But I want to say to you that in reflection, all these years later, it was kind of the horror show of active alcoholism is not what affected me so much. It had an effect, but it's the ongoing insidious kind of alcoholism stuff. The shame, the silence, the waiting for when it's coming next. Oh no, that breathlessness, that kind of the shame that they do something and I feel ashamed for it. Or I have this burning rage inside me, or I'll just kind of do absolutely anything to help you or to say, like that's kind of what the real insidiousness of alcoholism is. And I think that as I started to see that in myself, I started to understand why we see things in Al-Anon that we never saw when I started. I was like an Al-Anon snob. Oh, so you didn't have one really live one in your house puking and falling down in the hall. You don't belong. You didn't have one that was beating the hell out of you. You don't belong. I kind of thought that was the only orientation to alcoholism that you could have, and that's just not true. We meet people now who are here whose parents are, or they've never even married somebody, but somewhere in the family, there wasn't so much an alcoholic. but there was alcoholism. And if we take a look at the shame of all that, if we take a look at the silence of all that, if we take a look at the control of all that, and how that just is kind of this little insidious thing that works its way right in. Or people will say, you know, I'm living with a sober alcoholic. Well, doesn't that mean, I've heard enough alcoholics talk where they say that the alcohol is not the issue, so doesn't that mean the alcoholism is still ism? Isn't it still there, that they're not drinking, but the alcoholism is still present? And so we're here to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism. And then it just started to fit for this Al-Anon. And it started to make sense for this Al-Anon that we don't have to drink to suffer from alcoholism, and this stuff started to work. But, you know, in the midst of it, I did crazy things. So this is one of the things I did when I was a little kid. I'd clear all the clothes out of my closet, and I'd bring in a little table and some pencil crayons and paper and a little chair, and I'd hang a light over the bar that holds the clothing, and I'd make a sign that said, "Keep out!" And I'd go inside the closet, and I could paste that sign on the outside of the door. And I'd go in the closet and pull the door behind me and sit there wondering why nobody would come in. I was always looking for ways to protect myself, but then inside I said, "Please come in, please come in," but there was no part of me that could let you in. You terrified me, but my deepest yearning was I wanted you in. Or I'd build a fort. I was always looking for ways to protect myself. I guess that's what happens in the midst of active alcoholic drinking and the violence of what all goes on, all that stuff that kind of went on. And again, I'd put up the sign, "Keep out." And I'd go behind the walls of that fort and desperately wish for you to come in. But I was incapable of allowing you in. And what a metaphor for my adult life. I wanted you in, but everything about me said, "Go away. Go away." My eyes, my body posture, my words, anything. You'd get a little too close, I'd get angry, or I'd run, or I'd just say, "Hey, I have to leave." And that's a phenomenal metaphor for me. Is that because of somebody's drinking? Is that because my dad drank too much beer? I think not. But I think that that's what alcoholism, the family disease, looks like. And that's what I have, by the way. Alcoholism, the family disease. I own that fully. And all of the alcoholics in my life now are either dead or gone. And I still have alcoholism, the family disease. And left to my own devices, I would go back to all of it. I think that the best we ever get is a daily reprieve. That everything I ever was, I could be again. Everything. And it's like I've taken everything I was, and with the help of God and you and all the things, doing the deal, as my sponsor says. We know what doing the deal is. You know, you get a sponsor, you go to the meetings, you sponsor people, you take commitments. We know what doing the deal is. You do the deal, and I kind of put everything in the cage, and I close the door. But it's not locked. And if I miss something for a day, well, hey, that door might creep a little open, or I miss something else for a day, I miss doing my spiritual work for a day, it opens up a little more. It's kind of like Doc Severinsen. How many people are old enough to remember Doc Severinsen in a Tonight Show band? Every night, he's on television, phenomenal trumpet player, heard him play live once, a little aside, spectacular. But every night, he's up there with the Tonight Show band, and he's credited with saying this: "If I miss practicing for one day, I know it. If I miss for two, the band knows it. If I miss three, the world knows it." And we take a look at our program. If I miss something, I had a guy used to say, they said, "If I miss doing my spiritual routine, I'm a little crispy today. Just a little crispy today." Miss it for two, you know, kind of the family and the people maybe closely at work know it. Day three, everybody on the highway knows it. "Get out of my way!" We all know that. I was on the 405 driving on Wednesday. You have a lot of traffic. Lots. Thank God you guys have a program, because day three, if everybody was like that, it would be really something out there. But isn't that true? Like, so what Doc Severinsen said is the very same for our program. Everything I was, I can be again. Anyway, kind of growing up in this home, and funny things happened. Like, my mother didn't have anybody to talk to, so my mother would use me kind of as her 5-year-old counselor, the 7-year-old sex advice therapist, you know, the 9-year-old financial manager, you know, the protector. That's just what happened in alcoholism. And now, am I who I am because of that? I don't know, but all I know is that I am who I am, and that's the stuff that went on. And when I share that, people kind of get it. We do the welcome nod of identification. It's beautiful. You guys are doing it here now. Actually, now that I'm talking about it, you're forcing yourself not to. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to give him the satisfaction of nodding my head. I'm not going to do it. But if I was to stand up in front of, I just retired officially July 1st after 36 years of teaching. I was a high school band director for 36 years. Awesome job. Oh, hey, that's nice. And each year when I met the parents of the students I got to teach, I didn't stand up in front of them and say, well, hello, parents. Just so that you know, I haven't had to plan any kind of death, any students or mine, since April 10th, 1987. And they would clap and laugh. They would not do that. I would not have had a job. But I do it here, and we all laugh and clap, and oh, I get that. We identify with that particular insanity that says, I hurt, I will kill you. We just kind of get that. We get that our disease brings us to that point. That's what happened in the middle of all of that. And yes, I'm in the midst of this, and other things are going on, and I just want to tell you one thing. There was alcoholism, but there was an alcoholic. And the alcoholic would do things, and then we would feel things. So this is one of the things my dad loved to do. My dad loved to drink, he loved to garden, and he loved to remove his clothing. And so it does get warm in Canada for a brief period of time, and you know, from July 1st to July 3rd, and it's just cold all the time. After being here for 6 days, I see why people want to live in Southern California. So if I sold my house and every other house on my street, I might be able to afford an apartment here, but that's just like an aside, just saying. So anyhow, Dad would start gardening in the morning out back. Now you'd think, knowing that his predilection for drinking, gardening, and removing his clothes, he would start at the front. But he started at the back, so by midday, many beers in, the backyard looked fantastic, and it got hotter and hotter and hotter as he proceeded from the back to the front. And so by about mid-afternoon, he was right out front for all to see. Now he wasn't completely, like he wasn't illegally naked, but he was about as naked as you could be without being arrested. So if you can kind of get the image, you know, my father was a beer drinker, so we all know the magnificent beer drinking physique. And this was in the years when we didn't put cream on to repel the sun, we put an oil on to attract the sun. Okay, so you're with me, beer bottle physique, okay. Bermuda shorts turned into a thong. Are you kind of getting with me here? Sandals. And a cigarette outside, full view in front of the neighborhood. And there we are inside. I can see my mother now. You get in here now, you hunk, I want you. Right on the floor. The places we go. But then we had this guy in the street who would like to ride motorcycles up and down the road and cars up and down the road, and it upset my dad. He got angry. Have you ever met anybody angrier than an alcoholic? I have. The Al-Anons. They're the only people angrier than the AAs. The Al-Anons are the ones. But anyhow, my dad went after this guy, and the guy stopped the car, and they had this to-do in the middle of the street. Cigarette, brown stubby bottle, oiled up, beer belly, Bermuda shorts, turned into a thong, sandals, neighbors kind of gathering around. Have you got the visual? We're embarrassed. He's doing it. We're embarrassed. He's showing the world his ass. We can't show our face. Is that not a classic symptom number one of alcoholism, the family disease? You do it, I'm embarrassed. You do it, I'm ashamed. You do that, I hide. Oh no. What is that? That's alcoholism, the family disease. And years later, I'm happy to tell you, Dad did get sober. That was a great thing. Happy for that. I'll have one not drinking over one drinking any day. And then he really got it. Put the bumper stickers on the back of the car. Easy does it. Let go and let God. What does my mother say? For God's sake, Donald, why do you have the bumper stickers on the back of the car? Everyone's going to see them. I said, Mom, they've seen everything else. What's your problem? Alcoholism, the family disease. Shh! They'll know. The car used to be parked kitty corner, kind of on an angle on the front lawn. Regularly, the contents of the home would be thrown through the window onto the front lawn. Car would come home with blood on the fender. Take off those bumper stickers! They'll know you're not drinking. alcoholism, the family disease. But of course, they have the problem, not us. You don't believe this. I'm not making this up. Some people think I go to some places, talk to an Allen group, they say, what are you talking about? We're here to talk about them. Really. So I just read just a few tiny little quotes. We've already had enough reading today. I thought we might, when we're finished this, maybe we can kind of do a complete reading of how Al-Anon works in English and Spanish. You do a lot of reading here. But anyhow, so our Al-Anon public information posters say, is alcohol a problem in your family? Is alcohol a problem? And so we say, yeah, he is, she is, they are. That's what we say, right? That's our filter. Then we come to Al-Anon and we get readings like this. This is from our Odette book. Listen to this. Many of my punishments are self-inflicted. I'll say that again. This is in an Al-Anon book. That's abuse. It's them. Many of my punishments are self-inflicted. In some way unfathomable to my unhuman intelligence, my suffering could be the consequence of my own attitudes, my own actions, or my own neglects. Listen to this one, again from a Rodette book. If we really do want peace of mind, the first thing to realize is that it does not depend on conditions outside us, but those inside us. If I accept the fact that the principal source of my unhappiness is in me, I'll be giving myself a good reason to do something about me. And listen to this. This is my favorite one of all. July 27th, page 209 in our Odette book. Al-Anon's prime purpose. That's like the prime directive in Star Trek. Al-Anon's prime purpose is to help us deal with the problems that alcoholism has aggravated, not caused. As my sponsor says it, Rick, adding an alcoholic to a person like you is like sprinkling Miracle-Gro on your defects. Am I who I am because of an alcoholic? Or am I with an alcoholic because of who I am? Now, a book was written in 1938, and for some whacked out reason, in Al-Anon, they ask us not to mention that book. Well, maybe it's a good idea. It's anonymous. Quite large, if you've ever seen it. Some people can call it big. It just happens to be the foundation text for 12-step recovery. And in squiggly writing in our tradition 5, it says, we practice the 12 steps of AA ourselves. Squiggly writing means to kind of exemplifies that, highlights it. But oh no, don't use the book called AA. I don't get it. Just now I'm down off my soapbox. In that little, thanks. And I can tell you that there are places where people clap and places where people literally stand up and walk out the room when I share that. Literally. Literally. Anyhow, that book says something to us. So written in, kind of late 38, published in 39. That's what we know. Listen to what it says to us, the non-drinker, the family member. Whether the family has spiritual convictions or not, they may do well to examine the principles by which the alcoholic member is trying to live. Amazing. They knew that. And listen to this one, the granddaddy of all. I think when I was here, one of the conferences I was here before, this was your theme, our design for living. I think was the theme of one of the ones I was here at before. It says, our design for living is not a one-way street. It is as good for the wife as it is for the husband. Or in today's speak, it is as good for the family as it is for the alcoholic. And they knew that in Akron and in New York and Cleveland and all those places in 1938 when they were writing that. They discovered that. And here we are in Torrance, California, and August, whatever it is, August the 29th, I think, August 29th, 2015, and I think that that's still a good thing. It's a good thing for this Al-Anon to hear, that this design is good for all of us. And it works for me when I go from the side that says, it's you, to the side that says, it's me. And when I do that, I have available to me the most amazing set of recovery tools known. So what are some of the things? What does it look like for those of us in Allen? I talked about one of those. You know, they do it, we're ashamed. They do it, we're embarrassed. So there's some other things. In Al-Anon, we use these kind of funny terms, like, you know, I'm a people pleaser. Really. That is like the biggest misnomer I've ever heard. It insinuates that I have a scintilla of regard for your well-being. That never in my life has my motivation ever been to please you. The only thing that I have ever wanted from you is approval. And if I could, and I didn't even have to have your approval. I just had to believe I had your approval. And for a brief moment in time, that would quiet the screaming in this belly of mine. So I am not a people pleaser. I am well and truly an approval sucker. Do that with me. Let's make that sound. Group participation part of the chat. Do this. Yeah. And how many times did I spend doing things that I did not want to do to get a brief bit of approval so that the screaming would quiet down, and for a brief moment of time I felt that I belonged. Kind of that chameleon personality, just to get the approval. Hey, do you want to go to a movie? Well, yeah. What kind of movie do you want to see? I don't know. What kind of movie do you want to see? Oh, I love that. Hey, let's go out for dinner. Oh, that'd be nice to go. Where would you like to go for dinner? Oh, where do you want to go? Oh, I love that kind of food. Whatever you want, I want. First alcoholic I was with had somebody say to me, Rick, what do you like about this woman? Well, she likes me. What else is there? We also talk about low sense of self-esteem. Really, I think that's something I rise to, is low sense of self-esteem. My esteem manifested itself in all kinds of these whacked out ways. Like, you know, like I told you, I'm a high school teacher, I had these two university degrees, and I wouldn't have my picture taken for the yearbook. The time would come, all teachers come down to the gymnasium, have your picture taken. No, no, no. So for the first 6 years of my career, there's my name above a blank spot in a yearbook. Because I was afraid of my own image. I abhorred my own image. I wouldn't get my hair cut. I don't have much hair, but I have some. And I would hack at my own hair because I wouldn't want to sit on a barber chair and have somebody stand behind me, look at me in a mirror and say, how do you want to look? I want to disappear, is how I wouldn't buy clothing. Stand in front of 3 or 4 or 5 mirrors. And I didn't want to see myself. I bought a new suit. Hey, I've diagnosed with diabetes. I have lost 30 pounds. What do you think? Yeah. And I stood in front of those 5 mirrors and I said, who is that guy? Didn't even recognize myself, but I do that now. But in the past, not a chance. That's where my self or lack of self-esteem brought me. And we're not here to talk about self. We're here really when we start to do these steps, we kind of look at ourselves and then we kind of reach out to others. I've been hearing people say, you know, you don't have to give, you don't have to have it to give it away, to get it. No, what's the saying? You keep it, it'll come to me. Hold on. What's that saying? You keep it by giving it away. I heard somebody say, you get it by giving it away. You just start to give it away. You start to act. And it was somebody like, who actually sadly just died. Many of us know him, Dick Martin. He's the person I heard say that. And he said, in the beginning, he said, we're all like, you know, 1 week of sobriety, we're all working with each other and we all got sober. So where did all these rules come from? We have to be 5 years in and you got to be a man and to sponsor a man and a woman to sponsor a woman. Don't you just need to be somebody searching for God to work with somebody else? You know, if we're there for a minute, I got a little bit more. Don't we just have to, we keep giving it away and it comes. We get it. It's an absolutely an amazing, amazing thing. And that's kind of what started to happen for me. But there's even other things. So let's just take a look at them for the few minutes. I can see these people up here getting anxious. You know, there's no taper here, so I don't have anybody to kind of, you know, they look over and say. But I do have a timer, just so that you're all very comfortable with that. And that's just so I know how long I go over my allotted time. But I am with Dave about the hour, so hey, I know I got 11 minutes and 10 seconds, Dave, so I'm doing good. I got that time. Well, I started at 10 minutes in, but, you know, nobody else saw that. timer's on Toronto time, so we're doing real good. But yeah, what are some of the other things? If this is for me, if I have to recover from something, what are some of those other things? An approval sucking, or they do it and I'm ashamed, or I have like no sense of self whatsoever. You know, but just as a little aside, the way that I believe that I have risen from nothing to just a little bit is by doing esteemable things for other people. I think that self-esteem comes when I do esteemable things for you. That's what I believe. When somebody phones up and says, hey, Rick, you got a bit of time to talk? I'm watching American Idol. What are you talking about? Yeah, okay. When we do things that we really don't even want to do, when we don't want to do them, that's the most esteemable thing that I know to do. And that's what we talk about here all the time. But there's other stuff. So the big granddaddy thing for me was that I needed to have somebody who needed me. It wasn't that I needed somebody to love. It was just somebody, I needed somebody who needed me. I didn't know that I was like that. But I found out only in reflection. But in the time, it felt great. And so here's how this happened for me. I had applied to go to school in Western Canada, in Banff. Some people have been to Banff. And there's a beautiful school of fine arts there. I was in music school, and I did this audition, and I was accepted to go to the school. And as they said, you're going to be playing in a group with four other people. I was playing in this quintet of five. I played the tuba. And so we had a brass quintet of five people, and we were studying with a world-famous, the Canadian Brass, a world-famous brass quintet is who our teachers are going to be. That guy was my private instructor. And so they accepted me to go to this school, and they said, why do you call the other four people? Get together a few times before you come, have a few rehearsals, you'll be farther ahead when the program starts. Perfect sense. Made a lot of sense. So I called three of the others, made arrangements for a rehearsal, and then I phoned her. And I want to tell you that my kind of attraction to alcoholics, I don't even have to see you to know. Thank God I wasn't doing all this stuff in the age of computers. God knows what would have happened then. So when I called this person, and what was supposed to be a 5-minute time to arrange a rehearsal turned into this hour-long lust fest. And she had been places I wanted to go, and she'd played music with people I wanted to play music with, and she'd seen things I wanted to see, and she was exciting, and she was vibrant, and she was alive, and I was like bouncing on the end of that telephone. And so we kind of started talking on the phone after we made this arrangement for the rehearsal, and she started to tell me things. You know, like she got kind of personal. She said, you know, my father does things to me, and I go, really? And inside me, there was this little guy that said, I can help you with that. Well, consciously, I didn't know that I was doing that, but that's what I was doing. And she'd call and say, you know, my brother's doing some things to me. And I'm thinking, I can help you with that. And one day, I had my summer job. I worked in the liquor store, if you can believe that. It's a true story. And she called me on a Saturday afternoon, and she was drunk. And she said, my boyfriend was supposed to come over. He didn't come over. I drank this bottle of wine. Would you like to come over? Now, I'd been in Alateen for a long time, and a little part of my head went, bah. But another part of me said, I can help you with that. I know that one. And the time came, and we got to the airport in Toronto, in this big, long airport, and I'm sitting there, and my mother's on my right side, my father's on my left, and she comes in, and she's bouncing, glistening black hair, beautiful blue top. Oh, it was gorgeous. We just kind of walked her. She stood right in front of us, suitcase in one hand, suitcase of trumpets in the other, and she bent right over. Let's have that thought again. And my mother went into mild cardiac arrest right on the spot. The eyes popped right out of my father's head, and I'd been in Alateen long enough to know I was about to have a spiritual awakening. Because I had asked around about her and found out many things. You know, she was very cute, she was a great trumpet player, and she was experienced. And I wasn't, at least not with other people. I had to do something in that closet. Thank you for the laughter of identification. I didn't know stuff like that happened in California. So anyhow, we get on the airplane, and I ordered a beer. Now, for an alcoholic, you might not know this, but when an Al-Anon orders a beer, we mean one. And sacrilege, we might not even finish it. But she ordered five in the time it took to fly from Toronto to Calgary, Alberta. And if there's anything I say to you today, it's that she had five beers, because I have never met an Al-Anon in my country or yours who can't count. Absolutely. And conversely, I have never met an alcoholic who can. Isn't it amazing? They come in and we cut with that fabulous statement, just like the most obvious thing in the world, the alcoholic comes in and what do we say? You've been drinking! I had two. I think they learned that in alcoholic school. Alcoholic school 101, lesson one. Never admit to more than two, just call them a couple. Oh, okay. Class dismissed. Go have a good time. That's the one lesson they have. And then we get out there to the school and we start playing music and it was fantastic. And I discovered there's some things that are really awesome when there's another human being in the room with you. And then there's something even better. And if you're an Al-Anon like me, or as the alcoholics say, if you're an Al-Anon of my type, you'll love this. So we would play music, we would have sex, and then we would have therapy. Oh, beautiful. And she would tell me her problems, and I would tell her how to fix them. And I felt wanted, I felt needed, I felt valuable, I felt like I could stand tall among men and women. And a couple of weeks into this relationship, called it a relationship for a long time, and my dear friend Mildred said, "No, Rick, that was not a relationship. That was a parasitic entanglement." Try that on one of those internet dating sites, looking for a parasitic entanglement. You'll find one. Or as another person I heard him say, "No, that's like two ticks without a dog." So that's the kind of stuff with my thinking that I got into. I don't know about you guys. And so a couple of weeks into this thing, she says this to me. "You know, Rick, I've been seeing a therapist for a long time, but I don't need to see that therapist anymore because now I have you." Yes! And I, honest to God, felt better than I had felt in my life. The screaming vanished for a couple of weeks. And that's the problem with any man-made solution to a spiritual problem. We think it works or it goes away and we think it's working. Then it comes back. So my thinking says, well, just do it again, or do more of it, and you'll get the same thing that you thought you had. And so I found myself, after I graduated from university, sitting in front of a principal of an inner city school in downtown Toronto, and in the interview, he said this to me. He said, "Rick, we have a lot of very needy students in this school. Brother, am I the man for you?" And I dove in there and I did things with those kids that nobody said those kids could do. And 3 years into this thing, we did this magic show, Fiddler on the Roof, the whole thing. I conducted the orchestra, we did everything. This is a long time ago, but this is still a vivid memory. He pulls me up off of the out of the pit where I was conducting the orchestra, and the principal hugged me, but he pushed me back and he didn't let me go. And in front of everybody, he said, "Rick, I've made a lot of decisions since I've been the principal of this school. The best decision I ever made was to hire you." Now, was I doing that for those kids? No. I was doing it for me. Look at me. Look at what I'm doing. I am a user and an abuser of people. And I'm not an alcoholic. That's where alcoholism, the family disease, took me. That I would use anybody and anything in any way at any time to get a taste of what I thought was the solution. A control freak. How many Al-Anons here are control freaks? Right? Just a big, big fancy word for fear. It's all the control is. If I can get you to do what I want you to do, when I want you to do it, how I want you to do it, for a brief moment in time, I won't have to feel the fear in my belly. Rage and anger, kind of, you know, just kind of blast people all over the place. You know, I joke about this, you know, kind of not wanting to end anybody, you know, kill somebody else or me, but that was a real thing for me, quite honestly. And that was real. That was an insanity. I think that's a particular insanity that happens to the Al-Anon, that when it's so desperate that it really seems like a valid solution to the problem is to end somebody else. My sponsor did it trying to drown him in a bathtub. When I met her, I kind of identified. That's how we bonded. You know, our literature says men sponsor men, women sponsor women, la-da-da-da-da, and I was following that, and I met this woman. I heard this woman share about trying to drown her husband in the bathtub, and I'd try to chop at my wife's head with an axe on a camping trip. And after she talked, you know, we went out for some ice cream. She said, "Tell me about you." I kind of told her about that axe incident, and she laughed. We bonded. It didn't say that on the list of sponsors, potential murderer, but that's the way it worked out for me. That's just the way mine worked. God worked in that. So I needed to have somebody to work with me on this stuff, and on and on and on. So I would encourage you, really quietly, really honestly, if you're an Al-Anon, to answer in the deepest, most recess of your being this question. Why am I here? What am I looking for? Because the solution for our problem is here. The solution, if they are the problem, is not here. I can die sitting in these chairs if I am here to get better from something you have. But when I well and truly admit that this is how alcoholism, the family disease, manifests itself in my life, this stuff works for me. So like I told you, I got this sponsor, and she's told me that it was a phenomenal meeting, actually. And so my friend Mildred, again, goes, just one of the dearest women that I know in my life. Her and I, we used to, for many, many, many years, we got together weekly and did this prayer thing together. And so we were heading off on a retreat after I met this woman who was to be my sponsor. And so in the car, driving from Toronto to Lee's Summit, Missouri, to go on a retreat with Mildred, she said, "Have you found a sponsor yet?" And I said, "Well, no, I haven't." And she says, "Well, I think you have," because she had met this person who I asked to be my sponsor. And I said, "It's too crazy. She lives so far away, la-da-da-da." She said, "Well, let's just pray about that." And each day at that retreat, I prayed with Mildred about that. And on the last day, I wrote a letter to this person. And I said, I love meeting you. I want what you have. I am sick to death of doing this alone. And if you will be my sponsor, I will do absolutely anything you ask me to do." And I dropped that letter in the mail in Lee's Summit, Missouri, sent it to Little Rock, Arkansas. And about 10 days later, I got a huge package in the mail. And I thought, well, you know, she talks a lot, maybe she writes a lot too. And there was this beautiful letter, you know, "Rick, I got your request. It was lovely to meet you. I've been praying about your request for sponsorship. I talked to my husband about it." And his answer was, "Well, what's the problem? He's asking for a sponsor. What's the problem?" And so she said, "I've been praying about this." And then she said this beautiful thing to me, "Welcome to the family." Now, let's put this in perspective. I started in Alateen in 1968. I was a boy of 11 years old. When I was 21, they kicked me out. Said, "You can't be bald and have a beard and be an Alateen. Get out of here." I hung around in Al-Anon for about 6 years, and then I left, and I met that woman I was telling you about, that trumpet player, and that thing went south real quick, actually. And then I came back with the tail between my legs, and I was sitting around here for about 7 years without a sponsor. Listen, watching you guys get better, and I'm getting sicker and sicker and sicker, and the stuff I've been describing, I was doing when I was sitting in these chairs. And finally, I'd met somebody who I really just, sponsorship is so simple. You're there, I'm here. How did you get there? Will you show me what you did to get there? And she said, "Welcome to the family, the Al-Anon family groups." And sitting on my desk chair, I started to cry. After all those years, I finally had reached that point where I was willing to let somebody in to keep out was taken down. And that was the last nice thing she said to me for a year. She said, "You are one flaming sick Al-Anon." I took that as a compliment. How is it that the lower down you go, the more you think it's a compliment here? I don't know what that's about. But you said you're going to work the steps, you're going to do da-da-da-da-da, and I kind of ran out of time. But I got to the fourth step, I did the fourth step, I got on an airplane to do my fifth, and I sat with her for 2 days, and kind of she listened to everything I had to say. When I was finished, we went out in her backyard, kind of I kept my resentment list for my eighth step, but we burnt everything and prayed together at the same time. And when I came back in, I sat in her kitchen, right at that bar, Kathy knows it, Helen knows it, and said, "There is not a single thing I have not told you." And she looked right at me and said, "Rick, I love you more because I know you better." And it's like my whole life I had wanted to come to Los Angeles, but I was walking towards New York. And what the steps did was they just grabbed me. And I don't even have to want to do them. Matter of fact, I think that the effect of the steps is even stronger when you don't want to do them. I don't have to think that I want to do these to do them. I just have to do them. And that's what my sponsor said. And she gave me a direction for how to do them, and it was like they just grabbed me and pointed me in the right direction, because my deepest fear was that if you knew me, you would loathe me. If you knew what I had done, if you knew what I had wanted to do, if you knew what I fantasized about, you would banish me from your very existence, and my deepest fear would be realized. And what does this do? Completely the opposite. That when we reveal ourselves in this spiritual context, ourselves, and God comes in when we do that, we know that. I love you more because I know you better. And just great things happen to us. We have a gazillion promises, and then but specific things happen to us. And I want to reflect, I think, Angie, it was you that said it last night, that if we limit God, if the only thing we get from this is what we want, we are ripping ourselves off. God will give us way, 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 way more if we just kind of allow him to work. I've had two experiences this summer. I was in Montana in July and just in Maine 2 weeks ago in the mountains. I had this magnificent experience of looking out at the mountains, realizing there's God's creation. Man did not create this. Then I had this realization that God was looking at the same thing and seeing me in it. That's the God that I want to know. And that's the God that I've discovered by walking through these 12 steps. But one of the things that I'll just share, and it's really Danny kind of hit it yesterday, it's the same experience with him, is that I married a beautiful woman who has 3 children and I have no children. And her children are grown up. And 6 years ago, her daughter had a baby. 18 minutes after that baby was born, they invited me into the birthing room, and I'd never seen one before. They're kind of greasy when they're just 18 minutes old. But it was a beautiful thing that they welcomed me in, and they said, "You know, what are you going to call this guy?" And I said, "Look, they can just call me Rick." But as things have developed, this man with no children has three grandchildren, 2 of them who can talk, the other one's just 7 months old. And one grandfather is called Papa. The other grandfather wanted to be called Grampy. So the guy that married the grandmother gets Grandpa. So I'm Grandpa Rick to Lucas. And I come in, and they visit a lot, and he comes running up, Grandpa Rick, and little Claire comes around. And that was never on my list. Never once in my wildest dreamings did I ever say, "I'd love to have a grandchild." But God knew different. And so one day I get home from one of these things, and I've done a weekend on the steps, and I get home, and I always tell that story about the closet, the fort, keep out, keep out, keep out. And it was in October. And Lucas had been over on Sunday. They always come over on Sunday for dinner. He said, "Grandpa, come on downstairs. I built a fort." So I go downstairs, and out of our cushions from our outdoor furniture, which we, in Canada, you have to bring the cushions inside in the winter. I guess you don't have to do that in California. We have to do that. So all the cushions were in the basement, and Lucas had built a fort with all the cushions. And he said, "Grandpa, come on in." And so I'm lying inside this little fort with this little boy, and he's showing me all the things that he had done, and I'm saying, "Thank God I'm open to receive the message from wherever it will come, because God will speak to me in any way, at any time, through anyone." And I thought, you know what, it's pretty normal for a kid to build a fort or to do those things. What the alcoholism for me was to keep out. What Lucas was saying was, come on in. And isn't that what we say? Hi, come on in. Welcome. We don't want you to go away. Come on in. You've said that to me this weekend. There's a painting that stands on a side altar in St. Paul's Cathedral in London, England. Picture of a traditional robed figure standing with its right hand raised, knocking on the door of a cottage. In the left hand, there's a lantern, kind of vines growing all around it. It's a life-size painting. If you're ever in London, England, and St. Paul's Cathedral, go to it. It's amazing. The eyes follow you all around. I've been there. And up in the top corners of the painting, it says, "The light of the world." And underneath it says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come into him and sup with him and he with me." And as every one of us knows, the handle's on the inside. And God has been knocking for a long time. And what happens when we come here is they tell us to do things that we don't want to do. Admit I'm powerless. My life has become unmanageable. Do two, do three. And with each one of those things I do, I start to open the door and that God comes in. The greatest wisdom I have ever been given in this fellowship and in this program is this. My sponsor said it to me. She said, "Rick, you do not think your way into right action. You act your way into right thinking." And by doing those steps, we open the door and that spiritual awakening happens and we don't have to want to do them. So I thank you so very, very much for inviting me to Torrance, California. And remember this, we do not think our way into right action. We act our way into right thinking. And the actions we take are called the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, which we practice ourselves. God bless you all.